Us here today. We are engaged in a series of studies basically looking at Bible concepts and Bible events and trying to look at a little bit how this forms our view of the world that we live in. And today we are looking at the flood. And I was talking to Tracy a little bit before the lesson here this evening. I had kind of a weird time with this lesson. Over the last couple of weeks as I was putting this together, part of me wanted to put together the usual boiled down nuts and bolts, point one, point two, point three, tie it all together in a neat little package kind of sermon like I normally preach, like I try to do every week, like the members here are probably getting used to. And part of me was wanting to preach more of a, hey guys, look all the cool stuff I found kind of sermon. And I'm kind of... I think you're going to find this is going to tend a little bit toward the second rather than the first. And I'm doing this a little bit on purpose because really throughout this week, and especially in on topics like this that we're going to talk about here today, I want to encourage you to do your own research. I want to encourage you to dig a little bit. I put a slide up earlier, and I hope you were able to read it. If you weren't, you can get with me later, and I'll help you out. But there is a lot of information out there containing... facts, containing speculation, containing research, some of it in favor of the creationist position, some of it opposed to it, that will inform you as you try to make an informed decision. I did not put the most important resource of all up there, of course, which is the Bible. We're entering into this study. I trust you understand when we're entering into this that I'm going to consider the Bible to be the ultimate resource. In all of this, I'm going to consider the Bible to be the one unimpeachable resource in all this. You may or may not agree with me on that. If you don't, that's okay. We can talk about that later. But I think we will see the more we study not only about what the Bible says, but also about what science says, about what archaeology says, about what geology says, about what all of the different kind of disciplines that may or may not be philosophically inclined toward creationism. When we put all this information together, I think you will see that there is ample reason to believe what the Bible says about these things. And not only does it back up the Bible story, but also that the Bible story will inform all kinds of different aspects of our understanding of the world that is around us. That is particularly the case with regard to the flood and the flood story that we're going to talk about here today a little bit. If you have your Bibles, you might open up and turn over to Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. We're going to be looking at a few passages in this text that tell the story of the flood, that tell us what happened in the days of Noah. And also, we may be looking a little bit at chapters before that, maybe some chapters after that, some other passages in the Bible that tell us maybe a little bit more than you realized about what the world looked like before the flood. Science tells us, most of your evolutionary scholars tell us, that the earth as it used to be was very different from the earth that exists right now. And I think we're going to be able to demonstrate from the Bible that's true. That there were, in fact, some significant differences between the earth that existed back then and the earth that exists now. One of the differences is mentioned in Genesis chapter 1 and verse number 6 and 7, where the Bible describes during this second day of creation that there is an expanse, the New American Standard Bible says here, and this is one of those Hebrew words that doesn't really translate all that great into English. The Old King James, I remember, has the word firmament. Yours maybe have something else. It's basically the word for space. There is a space that is placed between waters that are above and waters that are beneath. And most Bible scholars will make this roughly equivalent to our atmosphere. What this is saying is that there were waters above what we would call earth and earth space, and waters below, you know, water vapor, clouds, the actual collected water, and that sort of thing. But there is a space, there is a separation between those two. There are many creation scholars who have taken to calling this a canopy. And the idea is that God intentionally separated these things and made a sort of bubble, as it were, around the earth. Now, the Bible is not a book of science, as we've been talking about in other contexts. The Bible is not given to explain exactly in what chemical formula and all this whatever is going on. That's not the purpose of the Bible. And so it should not surprise us when that's not what we get. But we do get a little bit of insight into this early world. We're told in Genesis chapter 2 and verse number 6 that rain did not occur in these early days of the earth. And some people have pointed out that that does not say it never rained before the flood. It says simply that there was not rain in those first few days, particularly when Adam and Eve were being created. And that's true. We don't know exactly how, you know, what kind of weather patterns existed in Old Testament days, especially in these pre-flood days. But we do know that at least for a portion of time, this was not the way God maintained his earth, that rain did not occur. We also read a little bit in Genesis chapter 2 in verses 10 through 14 that there were at least some differences between the landscape of the world that used to be and the landscape of the world now. We're told there that in the Garden of Eden there were four different rivers, and two of them were named Tigris and Euphrates. And most Bible scholars, a lot of them anyway that I've read, will grab hold of that and say, okay, well, this proves that the Garden of Eden was in Mesopotamia, because if you look at your map, there's the Tigris River and there's the Euphrates River. And we don't know exactly what happened to these other two rivers, but clearly that's where the Garden of Eden is. And I think that's a rather shallow way of looking at things. And it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you think about it. Why do we have these two rivers and you don't have these other two rivers? And think also, as we're going to be discussing this flood, this cataclysm that is going to encompass the entire earth, and think about what happens when things are underwater, especially when they were underwater for 12 and a half months. It's far more reasonable, I think we can agree, that there were four rivers in the Garden of Eden, and then there was a flood, and the world was changed. And when mankind got off of the ark and found a couple of rivers that they wandered down and found, they named those rivers after two rivers they were familiar with. That seems to make a lot more sense than two of the rivers happened to survive and two of the rivers happened not to survive. But either way you want to look at it, those two rivers are missing. The ones that are not the Tigris and Euphrates, indicating that something happened to transform the look of the world. Now we're told in Genesis chapter 1, verse number 25, that God saw this creation. He saw that it was very good. And that terminology, sometimes we kind of gloss over. But what that means is, God saw his creation as he had made it, and there was nothing wrong with it. It was the way he wanted it to be. This is before the fall, of course, before man got his dirty little paws on God's creation. At this point, everything was right. Ideal conditions, not only for humankind, but also for the animal world, for the plant world. Now, you and I know that the world we live in now cannot be characterized as perfect conditions by any stretch. Very good conditions. If the world was a whole lot hotter or a whole lot colder, whatever, we wouldn't be able to survive very well. But we can, with a little bit of imagination, imagine a world that did not have the kind of storms, the kind of earthquakes, the kind of volcanic activity, the kind of polar ice caps, the kind of dramatic changes in weather that shake up our physical world, that oftentimes make it difficult for us to survive, make it difficult for plants and animals to survive. That did not exist, the text says, in the ancient world. Back then, everything was very good. Now, that's what the Bible says about this. Now, there are some theoretical consequences that the Bible will support and that seem to kind of naturally follow after this. If you accept the basic Bible story, it's reasonable, and many, you know, people a whole lot more intelligent than I am in scientific things will say this as well, that if this is in fact true, then there is going to be sort of a greenhouse effect. There is, and that's not talking about global warming, not in the conventional sense of the word anyway. It would be global and it would be warm, but it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. If you have any experiences with greenhouses, you know basically how this works. I've always kind of wondered how the term greenhouse came to be a negative thing. Things grow great in greenhouses. The atmosphere is dense and lush. The temperatures are higher. Moisture is much more prevalent and easily combined. You don't have to worry about radiation and things like that. It's an ideal growing environment. And every reason indicates that this early earth that God gave us originally would have been like this, that it would have created this much warmer environment. We would not have had dramatic temperature changes. We wouldn't have had dramatic winds and storms and such. There would have been stable, warm temperatures. It would have been a much more conducive environment to animal and plant life and human life as well. We also know from our own experiment, not my own experiments, but human beings' experience, science experiments, that in these kind of environments, it's much easier to grow large things. It's easier to grow large animals and especially large plants. You may know about this in your own studies, that it is not especially uncommon for geologists or paleontologists or whoever to be digging around in some fossil bed somewhere and find a fern that's 6 feet tall, or find a mammoth that's twice or three times as big as a conventional elephant, or lizards that are far bigger than their modern relatives and things like that. It's pretty clear that things were allowed to grow much, much larger in an earlier environment. And again, there is some scientific evidence to indicate that this pre-flood environment supported that. I'll give you an example here. You know what amber is, right? Amber is fossilized tree resin. And sometimes you find a piece of resin, a piece of amber, and you go into it, you find not a mosquito that has dinosaur DNA necessarily, but you might find air that is in there. And the air has been trapped from the environment where the amber was created. And scientists have found that oftentimes in these little air bubbles in the amber, the oxygen content is much, much higher than in a conventional environment, indicating that an earlier environment in the Earth was very different from the environment that we have now, including a much higher oxygen content. This is what we're talking about here. Also, you have since you don't have the intense ultraviolet radiation, you don't have extremes of temperature, it's easy to see how lifespans would get longer and longer. Now, you're as aware as I am the remarkable numbers that are given to us in the Bible as far as human ages. We don't know anything about animal ages or plant ages, but we know that human ages were remarkable, and of course the Bible is ridiculed for such things. But when we consider that the world was created perfect, that human beings were created perfect, and this ideal living environment was given to human beings to take this over, it's easy to see that lifespans might be much, much larger. Now, this is going to come into play a little bit on Wednesday, Lord willing, when we talk about dinosaurs. If you are aware, you may or may not be aware about this, but reptiles, generally speaking, grow until they die. That's the way typically they work. If you have a gigantic crocodile, it's because it's an old crocodile. The reason snakes shed their skin all the time is because they outgrow their skin. That's what reptiles do. And you may have seen pictures in books or maybe on a movie screen somewhere of reptiles that were remarkable in size that do not exist in the same sense in the modern day anymore. Well, this may be an explanation for that. Maybe they just lived longer. If you got a crocodile that lived 200 or 300 or 400 years, he's going to get to be pretty big. Well, maybe this is an explanation for some of the fossil record that we have here. Now, on the subject of, I'm going to turn the lights down a little bit more if you don't mind. We're going to see a few pictures from websites and various places that you, and again, I encourage you to do your own research on this. This is one relatively well-known, well-documented artifact that is called the London Exhibit. Not London, England, but London, Texas, rather. This is found in Lower Cretaceous sandstone, and if you use a little bit of imagination, you can see a hammer there. There's the head of the hammer right there. There's the shaft of the hammer. And it's in this very, very ancient sandstone, indicating that a long, long time ago, there were hammers. Now, I don't think anybody's prepared to believe that dinosaurs made this hammer. What we do have to believe, then, is that somebody made the hammer, and it got placed in this ancient place. And now, the remarkable thing about this hammer is that its metallurgy is very different from modern iron. If I remember the science right, the iron that is here does not have carbon in it or silicon in it like typical iron would have in our modern metalworking. There is a large amount of chlorine in the iron, which is not a metallic combination that is very common or very easy to do in our modern environment. There's also a strange sort of anti-rust coating that is placed on this, probably by natural means, that keeps this iron from rusting away. Like, I mean, how many times have you left a hammer out in the yard? What happened? You know, it started to rust, right? If you left it there 65 million years, how much rust do you think would be on the hammer? Probably a lot of rust, right? Well, this hammer doesn't have that. And this appears to be why. Because there is a different sort of chemistry going on with this hammer than would be if the hammer were made today. Indicating, again, that the processes worked differently back then. Not only is there a hammer where there should not be a hammer, a man-made tool where there should not be a man-made tool, but it is constructed very differently than the hammer would have been if we'd made it in the modern day. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this global flood. And if you don't take anything away from this, please take this. There are a lot of people that, it doesn't seem to be as common a position now as it used to be, but there are people who will try to explain away the global flood and still try to hold to the Bible story. They'll say that this actually did happen, but the world was not destroyed. It was just a local thing. It was a Mesopotamia thing. It was a world of Abraham thing. It was a local thing. The Tigris and Euphrates ran out of their banks and it flooded the known world. And that's what this flood story is talking about. And I want to emphasize here that if you're going to believe the Bible, if you're going to accept what the Bible has to say about the global flood, you're going to have to accept that it is, in fact, a global flood. A simple local flood isn't going to explain the things that we read about. We read about 40 days of rain. You probably knew about that, right? If you didn't, you can ask your kids. They'll tell you about that. 40 days and 40 nights, it rained upon the earth. We've had some weird bouts of weather in Pensacola for the last 6 months since I've been here, including an awful lot of rain at various times. Never rained for 40 days in a row. Never any kind of downpour deluge for 40 days in a row. It's just not physically possible for something like that to happen. There's not enough rain in the atmosphere to make it possible for a consistent downpour for 40 days. Ordinary climate, ordinary meteorology doesn't explain it. What's more, there's also rising waters for 150 days, or prevailing waters, some versions may have here, indicating that not only did it rain for a month and a half almost, but the waters continued to go up, and we'll have an explanation for why that might have been the case in just a second. That's what the text says in Genesis chapter 7, verse number 11 and verse number 24. We read about the mountains being covered in Genesis chapter 7, verse number 20. Now, my reading of this topic indicates that the mountains such as they were at the time of the Garden of Eden, at the time of before the flood, the mountains probably were not very large. But clearly, at some point during this process, they considered the flood in terms of mountains. And if you have any kind of mountain of any kind of size, whether it's 500 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, tiny, tiny mountains, if you have anything that could even remotely be considered a mountain, and flood waters covered that mountain, you're not talking about a local flood. It's just impossible for flood waters to cover a mountain. That does not happen under normal circumstances or even abnormal circumstances. Genesis chapter 7, verse number 23 tells us that there was the loss of all life. Not all Mesopotamia life, not all local life. That the animal world, the plant world, the world that then existed was destroyed, the text says. That is not explained by a local flood. Along the same lines, Noah is told to build an ark. You probably remember that part of the story, right? Noah builds an ark. He puts a lot of animals on the ark. This is the most silly thing you've ever heard of if you're talking about a local flood. Noah preached, remember, for 120 years before the flood waters started to come. I have a question for you. If you're talking about a local flood, why did Noah build an ark? Why didn't Noah just move? You know, wouldn't that have been a whole lot easier? And if that's silly, imagine the animals. Why would he put animals on an ark if there's only going to be a local flood? A local flood isn't even going to destroy all the local animals, let alone all the animals in the other places. It makes no sense to have animals on the ark if you're talking about a local flood. The only explanation would be that everything was going to be destroyed, and as it turns out, that's exactly what the Bible says did happen, that everything was destroyed. Especially in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 6. And this is one of the reasons why we need to study the flood. That this flood, this destruction of the ancient world is seen as a prototype, if you will, a forerunner of yet another destruction that is coming. And Peter equates the two. He says that the world that was of old was destroyed, and it will be destroyed again. That there is another cataclysm coming, but instead of water, this time it's going to be fire. And if we are talking about a local flood that didn't, in fact, destroy everything, does that mean that we're talking about local fire? You know, that Mesopotamia is going to burn to a crisp, but we're probably going to be over here, we're going to be all right over here in America. So you're living on the right continent, fortunately. Is that what we're supposed to believe with that? No, of course not. We're believing in a global catastrophe. And if Peter is, in fact, talking about all things being destroyed, and I believe strongly that he is, then Moses, those who wrote down the book of Genesis must have been talking about everything being destroyed in the days of the flood also. Now, this being the case, putting all these things together, we get a little bit of a picture of what the flood would have looked like, how this would have all happened. This canopy, this separation between waters below and waters above, if this would collapse, we would find a situation very much like what we read about in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. On the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were open. Notice here two sources of water. In the first place, the floodgates of the sky were opened. Now, you've probably been involved in some very, very heavy rainstorms that you might have characterized this way. But when you understand the big picture of what's going on with the flood, it fits much better with the idea of all of the atmospheric water coalescing and coming down upon the earth all at once, draining the skies, as it were, for 40 days and 40 nights. This would have been a tremendous, cataclysmic amount of water. And there's also a second source. The text says also that the fountains of the great deep burst open, indicating that water was also present underneath the earth, and that volcanic, seismic, geothermic activity would have released this water. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a volcano or watched volcanoes on TV or watched the Discovery Channel or whatever, but there is some pretty awesome forces that are working in the earth's crust, even today. And the indication is from the Bible that these forces were exercised to expunge a great amount of water. There's still water in the earth even today. But evidently there's a whole lot more back then, and it was released at once. And it would have created incredible upsurges, incredible tectonic activity, volcanic activity, new mountains all of a sudden, new rivers, new streams. It would have been a world-altering event, clearly. This volcanic upheaval that we're talking about would have created massive new mountain ranges and oceans. The scientists, by the way, are way ahead of us on this. They will tell you right now that mountains are not necessarily ancient, that they grow, that they dissipate a little bit, but there is very much tectonic activity that is causing mountains to grow. And there's a lot of discussion about exactly how and why this happens. But we have biblical information to point us in the right direction, that this upheaval from the earth's crust created these enormous mountains. Now remember, the flood is going to rest the ark in the mountains of Ararat. And that's where it lights, right? I was talking about Moses being on the ark. Why do I do that? Noah is going to get off of the ark in a mountain range. The indication is that these mountains came up to meet Noah as the floodwaters were letting the ark down to meet the mountains. They meet in the middle, and they continue to dissipate. Noah landed on land and waited for several months until the earth was habitable. That's because the waters were still receding at this point. The text describes this in Psalm 104, verse 6 through 9. It talks about the waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place where you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth. God set things in place. He created mountains to go up. He created valleys to go down so that the water would be contained. And this is one of the age-old arguments against the global flood. And maybe you've run into this. Somebody says, if the world was entirely covered with water, well, where'd all the water go? Have you ever heard anybody try to argue something like that? If you ever have something like that, do what I try to do. You refer this person to Google Earth or to the NASA website or whatever, and try to find a picture from space of planet Earth and tell me what color the Earth is. You know, what you've all seen these pictures, right? What color is the earth? There's blue, right? Overwhelmingly blue. The water didn't go anywhere. The water is exactly where it's always been. Now, some of the water got sunk into deep recesses and allowed the water to drain down to expose land masses. Some of the land masses got pushed up so that it would be well elevated above the water line. The fact is there is plenty of water on Earth to cover all the land. And they've done scientific research on this too. If you chopped all the mountains off and threw them into the ocean and leveled all the land out, that the entire world would in fact be covered by water. There's plenty of water to accomplish this task. I think there's like a half a mile depth of water to cover all of this. So it's not a difficult thing at all. The thing is, where did the land come from? And God is telling us where the land came from. The land came from God's upheaval of the earth. Now, along these lines, I'm going to show you another picture here. This is the Grand Canyon, the Grand Canyon wall. And what you have here is the wall of the canyon and lines here of sedimentation. And now, I don't want to try to do the evolutionist job here for him, but basically the theory goes that as the earth ages, as natural processes take place, wind and water and such just kind of generally, gradually lay one layer of sedimentation upon another, and just you get these kind of stripes, like you get on the side of the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is kind of remarkable because you get kind of a cross section of Earth. You don't get that normally, but here you get this cross section, and you get all these lines here, and this is supposedly describing the age of the Earth. That the earth just kind of sat there while all these natural processes brought in all of this sediment and created eventually all of this rock. Well, that creates a bit of a problem if you believe that this took place over millions and millions of years. Because right over here, you'll notice the lines go up and over like this, like something down here in the bottom, some kind of big well of water or air or gas or whatever, was pushing up. Now, I don't know if you've ever dealt with sandstone. You know, had a brick of sandstone in your hand and tried to curve it. You know, tried to make a little bubble in the sandstone, tried to bend it like you're going to bend a bow or whatever. You probably didn't have a lot of luck with that, right? You don't do that with rock. The only way that rock will do this, the only way that rock will curve like this, is if this upswelling occurs while the sand is still forming, before it becomes a rock. Now, this is one of those things where you'll show the picture to the scientists and the scientists will say, yeah, that's weird, and go about his business like nothing's ever happened. Like there's his entire theory hadn't been thrown in the garbage can. But the bottom line is this could not have happened if the rock were formed as a rock. The only way this could happen is if these layers of sediment were laid down relatively quickly over a matter of days or weeks, perhaps, and before the sand had a chance to turn into sandstone, something happened underneath to bubble up and curve it, so instead of drawing straight lines like this, you get a little curvy line like that. That's an evidence from the Grand Canyon, as it were, that the world did not form itself the way that oftentimes we are told that it formed. If the global flood did in fact occur, as the way the Bible says, we would have seen animals flee to safety, as they had time and opportunity. You would see currents quickly and drastically remake the surface of the earth with erosion and layers of sediment. You would see life forms encased in sediment and immediately fossilized. You would see dramatic change like that. And I suggest to you that as we look at the information that is available, you're going to see that this is exactly what happens. And I would encourage you to do your own research here. Again, I've looked at a lot of websites over the last few weeks. I've looked at a lot of information, including some from skeptics, from people who do not believe in creation, and their explanation for all of these things. I try not to take it personally when I read this. The fact is, I'm trying to be civil about this. If there's somebody here who believes in evolution, that believes the world was formed over billions and billions of years, I have no problem with you. I have no issue with you individually. We're talking about philosophy here. We're talking about the Bible. We're talking about origins. It's not a personal kind of thing. Most of the anti-creationist scientists that I read on blogs and websites and such are just downright bitter against creationism. They take it absolutely personally, and I don't want to return fire with fire. So let's make sure that we don't maintain that kind of attitude. We want to be civil about this. We want to be open-minded about this. But I think you're going to find, as you do your research, there are going to be a lot of facts that are unearthed, that are unchallenged, that just exist, that put a whole other spin on the idea of evolution and the formation of the earth as we have generally understood. One of them is these so-called animal boneyards or animal graveyards. And I couldn't find a real good picture of this, but if you do much research at all, you'll find this. They are everywhere, on every continent. Every once in a while, you'll find some geological team announces that they found another boneyard. They've got them in Wyoming, they've got them in Australia, they got them in France. Every once in a while, you'll find remains of thousands and thousands and thousands of animals. And they are from all different kinds of walks, and some not walks. You know, we'll talk about sea creatures, we'll talk about dinosaurs, we'll talk about human beings, we'll talk about... basically, all throughout the flora and fauna of the world, all collected in one individual place. Now, you know as well as I know that animals don't have cemeteries. They don't make them for themselves anyway. Every once in a while, we'll have human beings that make cemeteries for animals, and that's a different story. But animals don't bury themselves. They certainly don't fossilize themselves. And there is no natural explanation for why it would be that thousands and thousands of animals are buried and fossilized in one place. That's not something, let me put it this way. There is a natural process that goes on. There's also an unnatural process that goes on that takes care of these dead bodies. We have a raccoon in our neighborhood. And I'm betting from driving around the neighborhoods, you probably do too. A raccoon that is dead by the side of the road. And it's been there for several weeks. And I don't know quite exactly what's going on with that. Maybe they do things different in Florida than they did in Texas. But in Texas, that would not happen. Probably because some redneck would grab it and cook it up. I don't know. But part of the problem is that we live near Spencer Field, and I think maybe the helicopters scare away the buzzards or whatever. But there is a process that takes care of this. I trust there's probably a governmental process. It just didn't work in very well. But if the government isn't doing a good job, that's okay, because God has a process. And God's process is going to work. It involves, first the scavengers, and then the birds, and then the insects, and eventually the bacteria. And before too long, that raccoon is going to be gone. Now, it may take 6 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever, but I guarantee you it is not going to take 10 million years for this animal to be gone. That's not the way animals decompose. That's not the way the world takes care of its trash. I think somehow we've gotten the idea that fossils just happen. An animal dies 60 million years ago and he becomes a fossil. That's not the way it works. That's why you don't go on Boy Scout treks through the woods and find skeletons everywhere. It just doesn't happen. Natural forces take care of these things. It takes extraordinary forces to create fossils. What apparently happened is all these animals were killed at once, thrown into some, maybe a cave or whatever, covered in silt, and the normal process of decomposition didn't work. Instead, they became fossilized. And that process is well documented. We understand how fossils take place. We're led to believe it's a slow, grinding, long, long process. I think we're going to demonstrate here that certainly does not have to be the case. It almost certainly does not is not going to be the case. We can see, for instance, this is the Taylor Trail in near Glen Rose, Texas. Maybe some of you have seen this or done some research on this. The evolutionists don't like to talk about Glen Rose because for years and years, for decades, they were very, very fired up about this trail of dinosaur tracks that were in this creek bed near Glen Rose that just, a dinosaur of some sort just step on like this. And look at all this evidence for dinosaurs. We're very excited about it. Well, they did a little bit of digging around in the area, and when they found right next to them a trail of human footprints, left, right, 14 of them, right there in the same strata as the dinosaur footprints. Now, you're probably aware that standard evolutionary theory holds that the dinosaurs were gone 65 million years before human beings ever came around. And so the question is, how did this happen? How did it come about that the same strata that has dinosaur footprints also has human footprints? Well, the flood explains it. The flood tells us, as we were mentioning before in the creation story, that everything was created at once. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more on Wednesday. And in extreme circumstances, there are going to be animals trying to get from one place to another. There are going to be human beings who are trying to get from one place to another. It's not difficult to imagine, perhaps even fleeing from floodwaters, that a dinosaur and a human being would go in, generally speaking, the same direction, trying to get to a certain place, and leave tracks in the mud. And then this cataclysm that would come would inundate the stream or the plain or whatever it is with silt and turn these prints into fossils, into permanent record. Now, nobody has any problem accepting the dinosaur prints. Well, if you're going to accept the dinosaur prints, we're going to have to accept the human prints also. There are many, many of these coalified trees that are preserved in the record here. Supposedly, currents are going to quickly and drastically remake the surface of the earth with erosion and layers of sediment. We have ample evidence for this. This tree, and by the way, we've documented this with volcanic eruptions, Mount St. Helens, and things like that. This is oftentimes what happens. There is a tree that is blown out of its roots, as it were, in this cataclysm, and maybe it's floating on some water or whatever for a while, and eventually it sinks, and it tends to sink vertically, and it goes into the ground like this, and it gets covered up with things. And that's what's going on with this tree. This tree, it goes up through what scientists would say is millions and millions of layers of strata. It's just buried, 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 again, millions and millions of years while this tree sits there. Now, I don't know how much success you've had in planting trees or getting trees to stay upright or whatever. Generally speaking, if you plant a tree and leave it there for 60 million years, the termites are going to get it, you know, or rot's going to get it, or some scavenger is going to come around and chop it down for firewood or whatever. A tree is not going to stay upright for 60 million years. And yet that's what we have in the fossil record. Does it not make more sense that the tree was left upright and then in a matter of hours, perhaps, rather than epochs, the sediment filled in so fast that the tree did not have a chance to fall to its side? This is a picture of the aftermath of Mount St. Helens, one of the most remarkable geological events of my lifetime. By no means the greatest cataclysm in volcanic history. There, when Mount Krakatoa erupted, supposedly there was enough sediment thrown up into the atmosphere that global temperatures dropped by 5 degrees for an entire year. That's a lot of sediment that's thrown up into the air. And that wasn't the biggest one either. Mount St. Helens is not nearly that big. Nevertheless, we are told that Mount St. Helens deposited 400 feet worth of sediment. If you've ever seen a before and after picture of Mount St. Helens, it's worth doing. It's like somebody took a gigantic ice cream scoop and just took a third of the mountain out. A third of the mountain is gone. And it went up into the atmosphere and eventually came back down and layered 400 feet worth of sediment across Washington State, including in one area 100 layers of sediment 25 feet deep in a single day. Now, I don't know how much trouble you have cleaning out your rain gutters or whatever. We're getting to be close to live oak leaf season, right? And I know how that is. We have live oaks in Texas. We understand how many leaves are going to be dropping from the trees. Now, can you imagine 25 feet of trees, of tree leaves, dropping in a single day? That doesn't happen. That's not normal. Well, that's what we have in the record here. And this is not, this happened in 1980. This is not made up. This is not fictitious. This is not something somebody told somebody at some point. We lived through this. There is also this canyon here, a series of canyons really, that gets up to 140 feet deep. And this canyon was formed in 9 hours. Now, the general theory about the Grand Canyon and other canyons is, of course, that there's this peaceful looking plain and there's this little trickly stream or river or whatever. And the river just flows in the same place for millions and millions and millions of years and carves out this canyon. That's the old theory. More and more geologists are starting to question that. They're starting to wonder if, in fact, the Grand Canyon was formed over long periods of time. And part of the reason they're starting to question it is because of things like this. This is called the Little Grand Canyon. It's a 1/40th size of the real thing. But clearly, we have an evidence here of a canyon that was not formed over millions and millions of years is formed in hours. And we know exactly how it happened. A mudslide carved that out. Not water, not a river. There is a creek that rolls through the middle of this canyon, but nobody thinks the creek formed the canyon. The creek went where the canyon was, because that's what water does. Water finds the lowest place and flows there. There's every indication that the same thing happened to the Grand Canyon. The Colorado River did not carve out the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon was carved out by a cataclysm, and the Colorado River found the canyon and started flowing down the canyon, not the other way around. On and on we can go. This is the Grand Canyon itself. And if I'm going to be taxing your attention here too long, I apologize. But again, I cut like half the information out that I found. This is a fascinating picture here, and you've probably seen it before. What we have here is different layers of strata, and the red stuff here, and this is overly simplified, but basically what we have here is the red strata is called Mississippian strata, which is named after the Mississippian epoch. There's a reason why Mississippi gets its own epoch and Florida doesn't and Georgia doesn't. I forget why exactly. Don't take it personally. This is Mississippian strata here, and the gray stuff is Cambrian strata, which is basically as old as rocks get. And the reason that they're identified this way is because Mississippian fossils are found in the Mississippian strata and the Cambrian fossils are found in the Cambrian strata. And that's the way things are dated. And it gets very frustrating. And exactly how they expect to pull this off, I'm not quite sure, but I guess it works. Because you talk to the geologist and ask him how he knows that the Cambrian strata is 500 million years old, he says it's because the biologist told him there's a 500 million year old fossil in it. And you go and talk to the biologist and ask him how he knows the fossil is 500 million years old, and he says because the geologist told me it was in 500-year-old rock. It just goes round and round and round like this. Nevertheless, what we have here is Cambrian rock, which is 500 million years old, supposedly, and the Mississippian strata, the Mississippian epoch began 350, give or take, million years ago. The Cambrian strata ended 500 million years ago. So what we have here is basically 150 million years of history that didn't happen, that is not in the Grand Canyon. Now, I don't know how your biology and geology classes went when you were in high school. I was told this when I was growing up. And reputable geologists will deny this. Reputable geologists will not say this. But high school and junior high geologists will. They'll say basically you can go to the Grand Canyon, you can look at from the top all the way to the bottom and just see the entire geological record penned out there right for you. Just the relatively new stuff at the top and the old stuff down at the bottom and everything in between. Nice and neat. Just like somebody just took a cross section through the earth. That is not true. And the honest scientists will admit that it's not true. And this is one example of that. Are we supposed to believe that 500 million years ago, here's the earth just kind of forming layer after layer, one after another, over and over and over again. Stop. Wait 150 million years, nothing happens. And then after 150 million years, we'll start again. You know, okay, we'll just start laying strata again. Does that make any sense? Is that the way the world works? Do rivers stop flowing for 150 million years just to leave information out of the Grand Canyon? No, it does not work that way. It makes no sense. And it gets worse than that. If you'll believe it. If you'll notice right here, this area right here, the kind of stripy area, okay, that's stripy for a reason. The red stuff is still Mississippian, and the gray stuff is still Cambrian. So what we have here is 500 million year old strata, 350 million year old strata, 500, 350. Back and forth like this. This is not creationist mumbo jumbo here. This is scientific evidence. And they have no idea how this happened. Well, Bible believers have a pretty good idea where this happened. If all of this strata, instead of being laid over millions and millions of years, was laid in a matter of months, if the entire earth was deluged and silt was flying everywhere and stuff was just kind of settling wherever it settled, it's not surprising that we have these nice, neat layers, and it's not surprising that they get mixed up every once in a while. Have you ever been in flood zones? Have you ever gone through a flood? We used to live in a house that was underwater before we started renting it. And we heard stories all over town about what happened with 4 feet of flood water. You know, what all the kind of damage, and you're aware of this, you know, 6 inches of water can float a car. Water does tremendously destructive things in small amounts. And we're talking about an entire planet full of water. So it's not surprising at all that something like that could happen. This is evidence of a fellow who has come to be known as the Limestone Cowboy. I don't know if you've ever run into this guy before, but this is a cowboy boot, obviously, and it's well documented, the labels in it. They're able to track down the maker. They interviewed him. They said, yes, in fact, this is a model of boot that we made back in the 1950s, and there's a human leg inside of it that's been fossilized. Well, we haven't had millions and millions and millions of years to make a fossil to stick inside of this cowboy boot, you know, that was made 60 years ago. Now, how did a fossil get put in a modern setting? Well, again, the evidence is, and there are other examples of this also. And I'm not going to tell you these things haven't been disputed, because they have. But there are many, many examples of things like this where fossils are found in a relatively modern setting, indicating that it did not, in fact, take millions and millions of years to form these things, that they were actually formed quickly and rapidly. You're probably aware of these pictures, or maybe you've seen them. If you haven't, they're all over the place. This is not creation mumbo jumbo again. There's a fossil here of a fern that is curved, notice here, and there's nice detail on the fronds and everything. I don't know how many of you plant ferns, have worked with them or whatever. If you've ever curved a fern, a fern frond here, how long does it take for the fern frond to straighten out again once you let it go? It's half a second, a quarter of a second, whatever. If it's left to itself, it will straighten out. In fact, if it's not left to itself, it'll still straighten out eventually. It won't take very long, probably. What we have here is a fossil that was formed before the fern ever had a chance to even uncurve, let alone wilt. It did not take millions and millions of years. It took a matter of seconds, probably. And there's other examples here. This is a fish that got interrupted. He had a rough breakfast, apparently, because right in the middle of his meal, before he even got a chance to swallow his fish, he got fossilized. How long does it take your teenagers to eat? How long does it take them 10, 20 million years to finish their meal? Probably not, right? Fish are the same way. This fish was eating, and before he had a chance to finish, he got fossilized. That is instantaneous, or all but instantaneous. This is a fellow called an ichthyosaur. Fossilized remains of this woman, actually, a female ichthyosaur, who is in the process of childbirth. Now, we have a woman who's going to give birth here, one of our members, in the not-too-distant future. I don't think she's feeling very good tonight, which is not surprising. Her family's here. My wife went through childbirth a couple of times. Maybe you have too. Most women in childbirth, if you tell them that childbirth lasts 10 to 20 million years, they might be prepared to accept that. That sounds about right, right? But we know, rationally speaking, that's not true. That the actual process of birthing a baby is very quick. Matter of seconds, this happens. Well, within a matter of seconds, this ichthyosaur and its offspring were fossilized before it even had a chance to completely get out of the birth canal. This is a jellyfish. Have you ever run across a jellyfish on the beach? How long does it take a jellyfish to decompose when it washes ashore? There's no bones in it. There's nothing there. It's going to get destroyed or stomped on or whatever happens to jellyfish. This jellyfish is still in place, still formed, still got its tentacles and all that. And while still in place, it got fossilized. And this is not, these are not the only examples we could point to. You do your own research, you're going to find twice as many of these, maybe better examples than this. The point is that fossils form quickly, or at least they can form quickly. And the ample evidence indicates this may be the only way, in fact, fossils form. So let's not get fooled into the idea that just because we have fossils in the world, then the world must be millions and millions and millions of years old. That does not necessarily follow at all. I couldn't help myself. I wanted to throw this in here. I doubt seriously that the author of Mother Goose and Grimm is a creationist, or that he's trying to make some kind of creationist point when he has his Grimm here, pretend like he's a dinosaur and tromping down the sidewalk and leaving prints in the concrete, pretend like he's a dinosaur. But that's basically how fossils are formed. Prints being made in soft residue, limestone or mud or whatever, and eventually they get hardened. They turn into fossils. Well, we understand how that works with kids walking down the sidewalk with soft concrete. That's exactly the same way that it happens with the dinosaurs and with human beings or whatever. this is the way these things are created, quickly, suddenly, without a whole lot of to-do. We can go on and on and on, but we're not going to do that. We're going to stop here. But I want to emphasize here, there is an ample amount of information out there, and I would encourage you to do some digging. If you find some interesting stuff, I'm a geek for this kind of thing. Please let me know about it. And remember, above all, before we extend the invitation here, that what we're studying here is the effect of God's destruction of all things physical. God brought all these things to a halt because of the moral decay of human beings. Didn't have anything to do with the dinosaurs. Didn't have anything to do with the fish, or the plants, the trees, any of the rest of this. It had to do with human beings. That human beings were not what God expected them to be, what he required them to be, and so he destroyed them. And he started all over again. And he preserved those righteous ones, those handful of righteous ones that were able to come through it. More on that, by the way, tomorrow night, and how these stories got passed down from generation to generation. A little preview of coming attractions for you there. But understand this. As we already alluded to from 2 Peter chapter 3, this is going to happen again. And there's not going to be a remade planet Earth, Earth, you know, 3.0 or something like that to come along. Everything is going to be completely and utterly destroyed. And again, God is going to not destroy the faithful in that cataclysm. He is going to preserve his righteous ones, however many of them, however few of them they may be. The trick is to be one of those righteous ones. The trick is to be one of these ones who are not going to be caught up in this destruction. And the way that you do that is by committing your soul to God, by allowing him to govern your life, by accepting what he has to say, not only about where you came from, but about where you're going, about who you are, about what your job is here in this life. And this book will tell you what that job is. This book will tell you that fearing God and keeping his commandments is why you are here in this life. And if you have been motivated in whatever reason, for whatever way, to give yourself to Jesus Christ today, to become a Christian, to be saved from the destruction that is coming in the perhaps not too distant future, we encourage you to take advantage of the time that is given you by giving your heart to Jesus, by submitting to baptism in water for remission of sins, not because the preacher said so or the church said so, because the Bible said so, because God said so. If you're willing to do that, if you're willing to give your life to the Lord and be the kind of person that you were born to be and eventually go to the place that he's trying to take you, please accept our invitation to come forward while we stand and sing at this time.